this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hi, this is Katrina from Zooming in the Lens podcast. What is the don't know mind? Does it make you cringe? It definitely made me cringe for a while. Because who doesn't want to know? I mean, the mind is what we're taught, and the mind wants to know. But how much are we missing because there is a lot that is unexplained, a lot that the mind can't make sense of? And do we tend to maybe push that stuff away because science and statistics and manuals and studies haven't proved it yet? I know I'm definitely guilty of that, maybe more so in the past than I am now. I know that the Tao Te Ching puts it beautifully, that the ancient masters didn't try to educate people, but they kindly taught them to not know. When they know that they don't know, people could find their own way. And I think the key, love the Tao Te Ching, but I think the key in that is their own way. So there's some jobs for the heart, some jobs for the mind. I'm here today and wanted to talk about the balance of the two. I think you could maybe be imbalanced and be too much in the heart. And I think you could be imbalanced and too much in the mind. And who's to say what? Nobody. Only you. I was always taught to question, to go out and experience. And that any lineage worth it would be encouraging you to not believe them, but to go out for yourself and experience it. I think that's not a lot different than what all of our parents or caretakers want for us or wanted for us. But I think America in particular, we lean really heavy on academic approval. And we all know that, you know, science is the study of. It's not the way it is without question. You know, science led me into a car as a child with the windows rolled up and my father smoking. They said it was fine. We know where that ends up. So it makes me very aware that my practice is in finding my own balance between the things that are unproven in life, which there is tons, and the things that are so-called proven. And then the things in the heart that don't really give a shit about things being proven or not. It's like love, for example. I mean, yeah, we would love to be able to define it in words, but if I was to ask you what it's like and for you to describe what love at its core feels like for you, I'd love to hear your explanation of it. And the explanation would have to be able to satisfy the mind and the hearts of everybody. But isn't it just perception? Isn't it just where you're at? Isn't it the point to be to go out and experience love rather than reading about it in books? I mean, the only avenues I've ever found that come close to describing the unexplainable is poetry. Poetry describes it. Whether it's your cup of tea or not, it wasn't mine for a really long time, and now I can't imagine not having poetry to describe the feelings and the depths and the colors and the textures of what love is. But really today, what I wanted to talk about as well is how we as humans push away that which we do not know. and how the don't know mind, which is what ancient wisdoms have coined it, another name for it is the beginner's mind. It sounds like death to some, but in the don't know mind, if you could imagine when you know something, you stop looking. You know, Gurdjieff, a philosopher, once said that you have to first know you're in prison before you can break out. You know, he's talking about the prison of the mind, just believing that that's all we are. And you know what? Let's even just play devil's advocate here and say, what if you were just the mind? Science has proven that there is plasticity and the mind can change at any age now. Change is inevitable. You're changing, I'm changing, culture's changing, our standards change. So if we are so steeped in only the mind's game, maybe we're shutting out the things that can really allow us to experience being human. I had Rena Joy and Kara Evans on the podcast last week, and they're the unexplained. Why are they the unexplained? Because science has never been able to prove anything about astrology or numerology. And personally, I've not felt a pull to that area, but I enjoyed having them on because I watched and witnessed how I showed up with Rena talking about all sorts of things that I know nothing about in regards to astrology. And I enjoyed it because I don't know what state my mind's in, because most of the time when we're asleep, I don't mean asleep theoretically, I mean metaphorically, asleep from consciousness, we just report out of our mouths and we're not really opening and listening. You know, that's what practice is for me. It's learning how to really listen and be present and not to just wait for my turn to talk. That's a mind's job. So having Rena on was really interesting for me, and it brought me to want to talk today about our propensity to push away that which we do not know. The don't know mind. You know, you could probably even just imagine now that if you think about something that you think you know, we tend to get defensive if somebody else comes along knowing more. We want to show them we know, or we stay really quiet but judging. When we don't know something, it feels like an openness. We are listening more. If the mind comes in and says, well, I'm not interested in that topic, yeah, maybe you're going to shut off. But the more practice we get in being comfortable in the don't know mind, the more we can open up to the things in ourself that we also don't know. And that journey is really what spirituality in a practical sense can mean for anybody. We all know that the brain changes now. We can change our judgments. We can change what we think is right or wrong. And instead of putting all of our eggs in the basket of the latest Journal of Medicine statistics or the DSM, latest DSM edition, going out there and really experiencing it for ourselves and finding a balance between the two, the mind and the heart. You know, I heard a phrase years ago, it was sitting under an apple tree waiting for an orange to fall. And how many of us have done that? We keep getting the same results. The mind is insatiable. You know, the more I want to know, the more I can never know enough. Because change is inevitable. You know, that's the one part of life that we just can't avoid. You're not the same person now that you were yesterday. So, you know, like an anthem to the mind, change is inevitable. And we find ways to embrace that place in us. And while we're sitting under an apple tree waiting for an orange to fall, we could sort of see maybe you're leaning too much in the mind, or maybe you're leaning too much in the heart. And maybe the key is to find value and grace in both of them. And the balance, it's a daily thing. It's not like you find balance in the mind and the heart and then you're good. It's standing as a witness to what the mind is showing up like. And maybe when we meet with things that we want to judge or roll our eyes to or put into a category as unproven, we can use that as practice. So that's what I hope to do by bringing Rena Joy and Kara Evans back on as guests for this podcast, is to challenge ourselves into an area that maybe some of you are really well versed in and maybe some of you aren't. But I know the general public, when we bring up topics of the unproven areas of being human, tends to get very judgmental and push it away. I'm not taking myself out of it either. But, you know, in the end, alternative thinking and Eastern philosophies and even religions, they can all be interpreted as the unknown. Because nobody was there. You know, we have these great books that create images for us of what it was like and give us tools for walking through life and for areas that we might want to follow, but none of them tell you not to go out and experience for yourself. And our relationship to not knowing is really diluted. Nobody doesn't want to know. We think it's a failure. It's a negative thing. Oh, I know. But when we loosen up on that and we go into the don't know mind, the beginner's mind, we can really hear that in Eastern practices, wisdom is in knowing you don't know, because then you have somewhere to go. So with that, I thought the topic of love would be a great one to start with. It could be explained, of course, with biochemicals, and I do love that topic of biochemicals. But it also is left mostly to me for poetry. You know, their poets are the only ones that have been able to really explain it in a textural way, in a way that I could sort of grasp onto, and it wasn't always that way. But as a practice, I went towards the things that I could approach that were safe for me. Me picking up Rumi or Hafiz wasn't going to cause me or anybody else any violence. And even though my mind was telling me none of this made sense and I don't know how to interpret it, I practiced shifting my perception with poetry. So maybe we can just shift our perception for a second if you meet with any resistance in any of these topics and look at it as a practice. Moving into the don't know mind. So we could really open up. Because remember, that's when we have somewhere to go. So with that, I want to welcome Rena Joy and Kara Evans to talk about the first topic, which is love.
Hello, my darling. Hi, Katrina.
Hello.
We're so happy to be back.
Yeah, there's nobody more that I would want to talk about love with than you guys, because you sort of span the array of, you know, being mothers and having friends and having family members, some we like, some we don't like, some we have difficulties with, some we can't get enough of. And, you know, when we were talking about love under the umbrella of not knowing. It made me think of this quote by Rumi, a Sufi poet. He says, "Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it." Oh.
Wow, that's wonderful. I love that.
I do too, because it's sort of, you know, he says it in one line, I say it in 10 minutes, you know? That's basically.
Right. But you know what we talked about, that there really only are two ways to live. One is through love, and the other through fear. So when we're afraid, we can love nothing, because then insecurity comes in and jealousy comes in, whether you're jealous because of a child, or you're jealous because of a lover or a parent. You've seen that in families,
yeah.
How destructive that could be. It's a fascinating realm of emotion, and it has negative and positive connotations. People say, there was a couple on one time on one of the shows, the daytime shows, and he, because he was jealous, threw acid in her face and blinded her.
Mm.
And she stayed with him, and she said, "I stayed because he loves me. I know he loves me." How deeply does one have to be proven to, even if they're blinded, to feel love?
Mm. It has literally blinded.
Yeah, it has to come from within. Obviously, if you start to take it apart, that woman had no love for herself. So how could she love someone else or let them love her? She'll only let him hurt her all her life. And that's how she sees love. It runs from that to Mother Teresa loving all of mankind. The scope of it is amazing. When you think about love and fear, and that's all there is, and it encompasses all the people on the earth, all, how we love each other, how we love God, how we love the earth, how we love our religions, how we love, like you said, what we know,
yeah,
without letting go of it and saying, I know nothing. And then the road is open to my learning everything.
Right.
Even about loving myself.
I think that a lot of people use the word love too freely. So even in that relationship situation with the woman with the acid in her face, but people say they love a ham sandwich too.
Right.
You know, I mean, right. They love everything. I love my pen. I love my job. I mean, do you really love those things?
Right.
So the word is thrown around without the depth of the actual passion and emotion behind it, and then all the different kinds of love that there are for different kinds of things, different levels, parents and children, friendships, relationships, and on and on and on. Every love combination and connection comes with different feelings that are attached to it.
Yeah.
And expectations. People say, well, I'll love you if you do this for me. I'll love you if you change. I love you if you never change.
Mm.
I love your apple tree story, because I had somebody ask me at a time when I was going through a love problem, a relationship, you know, hump in the road, and somebody said to me, well, if you just keep on doing the same thing, and I'm sure all the people that are listening have had a situation where they have had a confrontation or a recurring problem, whether it is with a child or a parent or a spouse, friend, mate, whatever, where they had the same problem arise, dealt with it the same way, and got the same result. and over and over and over. And this person said to me, if you continue to go into it with the same actions and the same results are coming out, what else do you expect? Mm. How else will you get a different result if you do not take a different action? That's what I thought of when you said sitting under the apple tree waiting for an orange to fall. Why would it? How long will you wait?
Yeah, and I think, you know, practicing things like mindfulness or silence, you know, to get quiet within the self doesn't necessarily have to mean that you're not speaking or that you're not playing the radio or you're not playing the TV. I think the metaphor is that all the answers truly are inside of you. But if we're always talking, you know, meaning the mind, the monkey mind, as Rena says, we can't hear the answer. So all we see is that apple tree, and all we're getting are oranges. And it, in other words, it feels like there are no other options. And that's the trappings of the mind. The mind is always going to want more because the mind's job is survival. And because the mind is fully aware, whether or not we're conscious of it, that everything changes. Everything changes. If you're safe 1 minute, you know, 1,000 years ago, the next minute you might not be safe. So we're carrying around all these lineages of human existence within us. And the mind, you know, as they say, is a terrible master and a great slave.
Yes.
Or could be a great slave. So in sitting under an apple tree waiting for an orange to fall, I know for me, years ago, I would have said, what the hell else am I supposed to do? Get quiet? What the hell does that mean? And for a while, I think when you find something that speaks to you, maybe even just starting with something that creates a passion in you that is not harmful. Let's just say that. Something that's not harmful to you or others. If you can understand how you could take something in from the mental way and take something in from the feeling way. So even just look at being a doctor. You read all these medical books, you take all these medical tests, but then you have to get into the lab and dissect. And you have to get your hands in a body. You have to feel it. And, you know, even in physical movement, the way I would teach doing a pose, say, in yoga or stretch, became miles different when I did an autopsy and I actually held the psoas, or I held the hamstring complex, than when I saw what it felt like, what it moved like. It belonged to somebody's vehicle, their body. When I went to teach it again, you bet your ass I had a completely different relationship to it. I wasn't just speaking of the hamstring as a medical book or an anatomy book would describe it. I had an experience with it. And it may not be my experience because it's not my hamstring. I'm not in my own dead body or alive body holding my hamstring. But that's where you can sort of dip into all the wisdoms of the world. And then you take it into yourself and you practice them. You practice getting quiet so you could hear yourself, right? And lately, like I was saying, there's nothing wrong with being in the mind and dipping into the Journal of Medicine or dipping into the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorder. It's basically what psychiatrists and mental health uses as a roadmap. If you have this, you probably have ADHD. If you have this, you have ADD. If you have this, you have bipolar. And then next to it is all the medicines that usually work for those conditions. But spirituality, love, self-love, any of these topics, all of the unknowns, right? They're all not describable. And they're all not in any medical book. And so do we just throw them out? Well, what happens when we throw them out or we act like we don't care is that we stop growing. And what that tells the mind in those moments is that the mind is the master. So I really think that it's about helping the mind to discover that there's somebody else in here. And getting that muscle built up, just for me, started with the things that I judged. The unexplained things. And I remember when I first heard Ram Dass speak, half of the reason that I even listened to him, Rena and Kara, is because he had a Harvard degree.
Mm-hmm. That's funny.
Isn't it? Funny
well,
and not
because
funny.
Because of your mind construct. No, anyone who's book educated knows more than you. And you could learn from them.
That's
not necessarily true.
No, but it is interesting to be able to reflect upon that and acknowledge it and see it now in clarity, because at that time, I am sure you weren't thinking it.
No, and let me tell you something. If I didn't reflect on it, it would have just, in my mind, would have processed it as, oh, well, that was then and this is now. Because the mind doesn't want, really, this dissection. And I'm not even saying to dissect it. I'm saying to build a relationship to other parts of us. It gives an automatic balance for the mind and, let's say, for lack of a better word, the heart. I'm not speaking of the organ. I'm just speaking of the things that are really difficult to explain, that we can even explain it through science. And then science will change their mind, because science is the study of. It's not the facts. It might be the facts of that moment. But there is so much going on in quantum physics and neural plasticity, understanding that the mind is always changing and you always have the ability to make new neural pathways at any age. So that's always changing, and we're valuing that. Why is it that we're not getting that there is more to seeing something or hearing a story or looking at a religion than pushing it away? It's that which you protest that is a great start. So in looking at love from that angle, I love this line that Ram Dass says. The most important aspect of love is not in giving or the receiving. It's in the being. Mm-hmm. When I need love from others or need to give love to others, I'm caught in an unstable situation. Being in love rather than giving or taking love is the only thing that provides stability. Being in love means seeing the beloved all around me.
That's right.
I like that example of love because it brings in a lot about, you know, it's a scary topic. I will be honest with you that there was many times I wasn't ready to hear that I wasn't truly understanding from a heart place. Anytime I heard anything about the heart place, I would immediately roll my eyes. I immediately thought, that's that woo-woo stuff. And, you know, I found that when I was really, really young, I was more interested in unexplainable things like ghosts and tarot cards and astrologers and, you know, the things that were unexplainable. I think because in our youth, we're open. Well, we're more open, let's say, right? And then you get maybe, if the more you dig that stuff, there's even an obsession with it. But the obsession, why I say it becomes obsession is because you think you're going to find the answers to your life questions, or should you marry this guy, or should you marry this girl, or what job should I take? And I think that's when it sort of alerts the same people that push away religion, or even religious people that push away spirituality in that context. Because, you know, religious people do claim that they're spiritual. That's their definition of religion, is spirituality. So it's, yeah, you know, it's totally overused at this point.
Yeah, it's hackneyed.
But you know, Katrina, nobody on earth has a right to tell anybody what to do unless they're 4 years old and they're running into traffic.
Right.
We have no right to proselytize what we believe in. I've learned through the hard way and through experience to not judge other people's beliefs, because I did. I did. If it wasn't what I believed and it wasn't right, and I don't feel that way anymore.
Right.
I say, live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
And but even that has, like we were talking about love, and we're talking about taboo love, which is also an interesting thing.
Mm.
Taboo love, such as there are actual websites for pedophiles who say that men, especially, who say that they love little boys and that it's okay, and that they are teaching them about how to truly love from a fatherly point of view, and that it's all right for fathers to do that with little boys. And that's what they tell them.
Mm.
And this is totally taboo. I do not condone this.
Mm-mm.
However, like I was saying before, in ancient Greece, it was absolutely acceptable. You had a wife to make babies, and you, as a man, you took in young boys as lovers. And that was pretty much how the Greek and the Roman men had love and sex. And it's taboo to us in this culture. Absolutely taboo.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are taboo. I mean, that is, yes, yeah, very taboo in our culture. But it's also taboo to, you know, some people to have orgies or to be bisexual or to be gay.
Right. Right. And finding out about Native American cultures, they felt that homosexuals and the transvestites were a wonderful part of their culture and of their spiritual rights. And these people were exalted,
mm-hmm,
in their cultures. So that's also goes through different seasons and different times. Homosexuality, where it's accepted by some and where it's hated by most. I think I told you I saw a thing on the news about a woman standing on a street corner, and she was against abortion, but she had a little child with her, and she had a big sign in her other hand that said, God hates fags.
Mm.
So this is what she'll teach her child. How could she ever teach that child about love?
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that love, or what is normal, for lack of a better word, for all of us, is what we see when we're growing up, what we're taught by the people that we grow up around, and the culture we live in. So that's where the judgment comes in. Because if you're raised in the United States, in the Eastern, you know, Northeast area, your values about love and family are different than they are in Utah.
Right.
And so that's why somebody here will immediately judge somebody who practices polygamy.
Right.
But in some areas, that's a religion. Who are we to judge?
Mm-hmm.
But judgment comes from that not knowing, because it triggers the fear and your radar goes up. I don't know what that is. That's foreign to me. That's disgusting. And all the judgments come in. And
the brain maybe understands at that point that there's danger. So that's,
correct,
you know, that's why we then fight against it. But if we look at it logically, if we were truly to say, that's what you believe, and this is what I believe, and what they believe is technically not affecting you, you know, but then you speak to some political parties who say, it doesn't affect you now, but if we accept that, then the whole culture will change, and there'll be no there'll be no room for, you know, holding on to tradition. They feel that they're valuing, like I said, they're valuing consistency, and they're not growing. So we do value being consistent. We want it to be 1950s, where a man and a woman get married. And I just say, just question it. What's it going to do to question? I'm not saying there's any right or wrong. What the hell do I know? But I'm saying the fact that we're all just like lemmings, just not questioning it and saying, ooh, I don't like that, or ooh, I love that. Like Kara said, I love a ham sandwich. I love my husband, or I love my wife. Like, we're overusing everything. It's almost like anatomically, you would say that you don't want to stretch ligament, because once you stretch ligament, it doesn't go back. And so then there's no stability. And it feels like that. The more we overuse the word love, and we don't ever stop to question, like, what is it I'm really feeling, and why do I push away this or that belief or this person? And like Kara said, it's when it's because not knowing, and our relationship to not knowing, it has an automatic fear panic button. Mm-hmm. So if we could just have dialogue about what not knowing really means, and how it's not coming from a lack. It's coming from those who know don't even feel the zest to tell others. Like, you know right now how to go to the bathroom, right? You're not running around. You don't have a passion to run around the street and teach everybody how to go to the bathroom. It's sort of like that, they say, with the esoteric teaching. So it ends up coming out very esoteric. Because once you're there, you're there. So when you're not there, look at the things that we push away. Look at the, I don't believe in gay marriage, or I don't believe in bisexuality, or I don't believe in, you could love somebody for 40 years, or I believe you should only love somebody for 40 years. It's just getting that curiosity to question, where do you really feel that from?
Right, is it old tapes? Is it your father's fear?
Mm-hmm.
Is it someone else's fear that shoved it down your throat?
How about, where do you really feel the opposition?
Right.
Where does that come from?
And maybe it is just in me, and it's just coming from my mind. And so if that's the case, then if I slowly try to practice sitting down and writing everything that I think is wrong about a certain kind of love, like if I thought homosexuality was wrong. If you write it down and you claim that you're logical, I dare you to make a logical argument as to how that love is any less than the love you feel for your husband or wife or what do you call it?
Partner.
Yes. I was looking for another word. I can't think of it.
Because
heterosexual love. There it is. Heterosexual love.
Heterosexual and homosexual. Love is an emotion, and emotions and feelings are never right or wrong. They just are. Acting on them can be right and wrong.
Mm.
In other words, killing an abortion doctor because you hate abortion and not seeing that as murder, yet seeing abortion as murder, is wrong. You could feel what you feel, but we have no right to cross a certain line. The man who said, I love you, and now I'll blind you so no one else will want you,
right,
is wrong.
Well, those are all extremists.
Yeah, and there are extremes even in love. There's suffocating love.
Yeah, and it starts when we try to identify ourselves, like in school. When there's bullies, and you're not like me, or I don't feel good about myself, so I'm gonna make sure that nobody likes you. And so everybody mm-hmm. gangs up on each other. And at that point in our lives, I think we're just trying to exert our isness, you know, our personality mm-hmm. to prove that we're really here. But that's an external here. And I remember that in school. I had a bully, and then I was a bully. Oh, it was horrific. Mm. But having the experience of being both of them, it makes me understand how, you know, how alluring, I mean, how alluring and seductive the mind is. I could sit and research for 17 hours, and I could meditate for an hour, and it feels like 5 days. Because the perception in my mind is that I'm not gaining anything. But what I'm saying is that this is at least how I've been able to practice, is by allowing my mind to just be a mind. I don't need the mind to change, nor am I under any illusion that I'm going to talk my mind into thinking differently. That's why I think this topic is really important, because I think Einstein had a great quote, which I'll butcher, but it's you can't realize consciousness from the same level of consciousness that created it. Mm-hmm. So I can't sit down to meditate and my mind tells my mind, shut up, stop talking. This is, you know, the fact is that you've been here way less time than you were researching this on the computer or reading a book or painting or whatever. I there's no chance. I cannot win that. That's where that word surrender comes in, not being a bad word either. So I see the mind and I say, okay, you be the mind, and I'm going to simultaneously watch you. I'm going to witness, and that's the part of me that's meditating. That's the part of me that went from 3-minute alarm meditating to 5-minute to 10-minute, where the mind would then go, wow, you went 10 minutes. Congratulations. That's fantastic. You know, and then to 15 minutes to, you know, so on and so on and so on. It wasn't that my mind went, okay, I can see the purpose of this meditation thing. It never did that.
No.
And I don't know if it ever does, and I can't really put my stock in that, because to me, that's the part of me that wants to be consistent and doesn't really want to experience. The experiencer becomes the heart. So you're simultaneously doing both.
And it felt good.
Well, it felt good after the fact to the mind, but while I was doing it, absolutely not. The mind kept saying, this sucks. I have an itch. I'm hungry. Oh, my God. I forgot to, you know, clean out the kitty litter. Mm-hmm. You know, the mind's busy being the mind. And that's the sitting under an apple tree waiting for an orange to fall, Kara. For me, it's when I look at the mind as something that needs to be in practice. It's not the mind that's in practice.
Yeah, I have a similar experience with meditating. It's fun. No one ever explained it that way, but and people do put a lot of pressure on themselves. I know meditating is a whole other topic than where we were, but right. You know, it's the things your mind tells you and then how you interpret them. And you know, people will say, well, I meditate. I was at that Tibetan Buddhist weekend, and they meditated for 3 straight days, 24 hours. That temple was full 24 hours, and I was thinking, In less than a minute, my chattering mind was already telling me things I didn't do, needed to do, where I had to go. But I've really learned for myself to work with that.
Yeah.
Because you really can't turn it off. You kind of have to just own it and let it be. And that in itself becomes your meditation. But a lot of people say, how do I meditate? I can't shut off my mind. But who really shuts their mind? Can you shut a mind?
No. I don't believe you can. I mean, maybe there are some lineages that say you can, and maybe that's one route. But for me, I'm having a love affair with my mind now rather than being in hell with it. Because I have to honor it. It's gotten me this far. I do value it. I do love it. I do love the things that the mind can do. I just don't want the really important events to be stunted by the lack of acceptance that the mind, my mind, seems to carry around with it. I don't think I could ever be smart enough. And the mind is happily going to tell me that. And then what that does is it stops me from trying anything because I'm waiting to be smart enough, or I'm waiting to be practiced enough, or I'm waiting to be a monk, or, you know, whatever, waiting to get the perfect job, waiting to have enough money, waiting till this guy treats me like shit so it's easy to leave, you know? That's the job of the mind. And, you know, I started just being lighter. Like you said, Kara, we say the word love all the time in terms of like a ham sandwich, and then how does it show any value? And I'm not saying stop saying you love a ham sandwich. I'm saying, can you witness yourself saying that and then differentiate the difference between the love of a ham sandwich and the love of your mother or father, or if you have a shitty relationship.
Down.
Yeah, I mean, writing down for me is key.
Yes, write it down. Why do you love a ham sandwich?
Yeah, yeah.
And the relationship between your mind and your heart becomes interesting, because if you're talking about love, as we're speaking about it, it becomes what interrupts your interpretations of love, because it tells you when you're jealous, or when you're questioning, or when you're worried, or when you're feeling insecure, or you don't have that self-esteem. And that's that battle between your own mind and your heart. And it takes a life of its own sometimes, at least for me it does.
Yeah, and I sort of look at my mind as the lights on my car when you're driving at night. Like, I don't want to drive in the dark, you know? So I just put my lights on, and they shine wherever I point the car.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's illumination.
Right. But if I don't have lights all around my car, you know, I'm only seeing what's in front of me. And so we tend to only see that perspective.
But tunnel
vision, right. And I think that there's value to what's in front of you. Like, the heart may not be the best tool to use when you're crossing a busy street. I think you use the mind for so much, but that dialogue that you use in, the dialogue that you have that you feel is the enemy stopping you from loving somebody, like we said at the last podcast, somebody short, or somebody with blonde hair, you know, that part of the mind, it's limited. And so that's why we always get into relationships or situations and they feel good at first, but eventually the mind's job to propel you and move you forward and get you to the next place is leaving you dissatisfied in what was once great.
So, it's called an imago.
That's what you said last time. That's exactly what you said last time.
It's setting up, I'll only go with blonde, blue-eyed men, 6'2", that's it. Or I only like brown women, or I only will go out with butch guys, or whatever it is. It's called an imago, and it's so tenuous, because the first thing to go is the lust. And that's not love. That's eros.
Well, if I can interrupt for a second. Maybe if you want to hear the things that we were talking about the colors associated with love and the types of love reflected by those colors, I think everybody that's listening will relate at least to one. I relate to more than one myself at different times in my life. But it's really interesting.
Well, what if we listen to it also from the perspective of, you don't have to believe it. Just open up and receive it and take
See
out
if
of
you
it,
felt it.
Right. And if you're opposed to it or your eyes roll or you feel like that doesn't make any sense, maybe it gets you at least questioning other things than, you know, why do I feel opposed to that?
Mm-hmm.
It might not
That's
feel
right.
natural. Like, I'm not saying that it's going to feel natural to hear colors, you know, aligned with love. But, you know, that's the challenge is if you keep listening to podcasts that are just talking about the things you get and you understand, why don't you go and start a podcast yourself? You're just listening to yourself. That's what happens in love. You're just looking for yourself in everybody. So, you know, to find the perfect person, you have to be the perfect person. Otherwise, you're not going to find the perfect person. So,
good luck. And there's no perfect anything.
Exactly. So, yeah, challenge us. Let's hear it.
Okay, so here we go. So the first one, remember that this is through the lens of observation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Number one is Eros. It's the color red, and that's physical love. Attraction to people who are physically attractive. Intense and passionate, but you lose interest quickly. That's what I was talking about. Then we have two, Ludus, L-U-D-U-S. The color is blue, and that's game-playing love. Lovers having fun, playful, and very casual, avoiding commitments, like a booty call. And but they lean towards cheating after a while and very rarely share anything personal with each other.
Hmm.
Then you have three, it's called mania. And the color is violet. And these loves are possessive and manic and codependent and demanding. And they confuse love with obsession. That could be a very dangerous kind of love. Then you get four, agape, which is orange, and that's an unselfish love, focused on giving rather than receiving, showing great concern for partner's well-being, but it could have issues of codependency. As with everything, there's going to be negative and positive. Five is pragma. The color is green, and that's practical love, searching for someone who fits a particular image. Here you have the imago, based on age or wealth or physical or cultural. It's internet dating. Because you're going to answer questions and you're going to get someone who's answered the questions in a similar way, and they're going to match you up to someone who's almost exactly like you, unless they've been lying, which happens too. Then the last one is storge, S-T-O-R-G-E. It's yellow, and it's called compassionate love, and that's about friendship, shared values, compatibility, long-time relationships. Often see their love transformed into this type of love. So I found that very interesting, and I know for myself I've been in most of these loves.
Mm.
During the course of my life and three different husbands, it's going to happen.
And what lineage is that from? Like, not that lineage matters, but I want to know what that belief system is leaning
to. It's from this psychologist. It's he takes a lot of things. His theories are based on Greek teachings and loves. And it's about love styles and compatibility. Constructed through the lens of observation.
And what's the benefit of knowing the colors? Like, what do the colors have anything to do with those?
Well, colors belong, like you said, a color wheel of love. Colors have vibration. And each color has a different vibration. What I do, I do something called candle magic. I teach people how to make candles, because every time we light candles, we're invoking the spirits. That's why people light them in church or on Hanukkah or on Shabbos. We light candles, we say prayers. Anyway, every color brings on a different energy. If you want money and success,
you do green. If you want passion, you do red. If you want love, you do pink. The chakras all have different colors.
Are they? Do they all align together? Sorry to interrupt you, but are they all similar? Like the colors of the chakras, are they aligning with this person?
Every chakra has a different color.
Oh no, I know that. I'm saying, does the color orange in the chakras, is it the same meaning with the color orange of this psychologist?
I have to look into that.
Is there any correlation?
That's an interesting question.
Well, because you said violet was like aggressive, and I know that that's considered the seventh, you know, chakra. That's the crown chakra color. So I know that that's not evil.
The head.
Right.
Yeah, but listen, it's demanding and it's confusing love with obsession.
Hmm.
And confusion comes from the brain.
Right, right. Interesting.
For the most part.
Right.
You know, that's an interesting, I never thought of it like that, that these codes could be combined with the chakras.
Well, from a very simple point of view on color, without everything you just read, when people are sad, they say they feel blue.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're angry, you feel fire and heat
red.
Associated with red.
Yeah.
So that's not even something, I don't even know where that originated, but I think associations with colors will be based a lot on that. And is interesting about the chakra colors and where we would love with those different parts of our body, because
yeah,
the chakras are aligned from our head to our base of our spine in alignment with those colors. That would be interesting to know.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, because there's somebody named Ken Wilber. And Ken Wilber has a whole example and system that he does with colors and people and their expressions in life and personality types.
And auras even have colors.
Right, but even practical applications of what you read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was given one practical application that stayed with me as a good way to see what maybe you're speaking about. But when you wake up in the morning, I know I at least used to tend to wait till I was woken up to pick out my clothes for the day, or I'd pick them out the night before because I'm not so conscious in the morning to be able to pick out something that would match. I'd probably walk out of the house, you know, with a hula hoop around me thinking that that's a suit of some sort. So I do it. Yeah, so I do it at night. Well, the tutu and combat boots was really great too once.
Yeah.
So I woke up in the morning. I was given the homework to wake up, open my eyes, get out of bed, and go right to the closet and see what in my closet I was attracted to before my mind overcame me and, as we call it, woke up, which is the antithesis of actually what I think it is. But before the mind wakes up, where is your attention going? Is your attention going to a black shirt, a white shirt, a green shirt? And without even having to get into the woo-woo parts of what that could mean, it's getting to know yourself from a different place. If every day you wake up, you're doing the same exact thing, brushing your teeth, then you get coffee, then you sit down, you check your email, or you check your phone before you even brush your teeth. Just trying something different by being able to get up and see what colors attract you before the mind fully has its positioning in your day is an interesting thing to do. If you then want to take it further, you could look into all the different systems like chakras or Indian, Native American, and what they represent. But even prior to that, what color is the inside of your house? What color is in your favorite room on the walls? What color are your sheets? Do you tend to like get cream sheets? Do you tend to really like deep reds on your comforter? Because there is also some science on our attractions to certain colors, but I think it goes more to a deeply rooted psychological makeup, like possibly what that color was for you as a child or You know, because science is basing it in things that are tangible. So you could take it in any direction, colors.
You remember the movie with Goldie Hawn and Susan Sarandon?
Yes.
What was that called?
The Baker Sisters, I think. Not Baker. The sisters. One wore
one
beige.
One was beige, and one was very colorful and flowers in her hair. And it's funny, I have a friend who's a dear friend, and I love her, but she's a very straight player, conservative, and I always tell her, you're the beige one.
Yeah.
Wow. Right? I mean, we all have a propensity to certain colors or wanting tons of colors. And, you know, there's an action of self-study in that, because we don't even stop to do it. We just paint our, you know, paint that living room or get the color car because, well, why do you have that color car? Well, because it hides dirt better. I mean, yeah, of course, you can look at all of life.
Oh, remember when we were putting on our makeup in the bathroom together when we were in Las Vegas?
No.
And we said, we never do this. We were going out and we both sat there and we painted our faces.
Right.
Makeup and eyeliner and eyeshadow. And
right.
We wanted to try every little thing we both had. And we looked in the mirror at each other. We were all beautiful and dressed up. We were like, we never do this.
Never.
Fun experience.
It was fun because it's never done. And yeah, like doing something different, it brings out another part of you. And you know, when you were reading that, which was really interesting, Rena, I would love for you to post that on your Facebook, a copy of that, just, you know, to get more information on the different types of love that that psychologist is reporting. In Buddhism, in the Zen lineage, they don't describe different types of love, but they define true love. So I probably resonate a bit with this, that there's no difference in any type of love, meaning romantic love, family love, friendship. They're all under the same umbrella. But it's the definition of what true love is. And they have it in these four elements. And the first one is, does the love offer and receive happiness? So they would call that Maitri. Do you give happiness? Are you happiness? Do you give it? And does that person give it back to you? And are they happiness? Which I think is very important. It's different than just walking around looking at the glass half full. This isn't about power of positive thinking. It's the difference between being and doing.
Mm-hmm.
Being happiness is different than doing happiness. Today I'm going to have a good day. You're talking yourself into it. It's like me sitting in meditation saying, okay, mind, you need to meditate. I don't get anywhere with that. So does it do that? Number two is compassion. Is compassion in you? And is it in the other person? So naturally it would flow to your partner and from your partner back to you. So number two is compassion. And the ability, because you're practiced in whatever it is that you're practicing, are you able to transform it? Are you able to transform suffering into compassion for yourself, which then allows you to be able to meet somebody else's suffering from compassion? When we can't meet somebody else's suffering from compassion, we can probably hold the mirror up and see that we have a hard time doing that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And is the other person able to transform their suffering into compassion for themselves? So you see, everybody, the recipe here is that they're working on themselves. So this is the definition of true love. So that is number two. Number three is joy. And if somebody's making you cry all the time, I heard Thich Nhat Hanh say this, if somebody's making you cry all the time, that's not true love. That's not joy.
No, so, that's control.
Possibly, yeah. But that's not that. Are they joyful? Are you joyful? And I'm not talking about being in a good mood. That's a mind's job. But running simultaneously, is there elements of joy living in you and living in your partner so that you can be joyous together?
Also, don't you think that that's part of being really honest with yourself?
Absolutely.
Because I've seen people who say, oh, I'm very happy. My life is very happy. I love my husband. And I could see in the eyes such a death.
Well, that's what she's talking about, so joy from within.
Joy in yourself, right. A pleasure, a gratitude.
Yes.
For living.
We have all bullshitted ourselves plenty of times.
Mm-hmm.
We are all capable of convincing ourselves that we are happy in a situation when we're truly not.
And we're not.
And it's really scary to admit to ourselves, let alone out loud, that we're not happy in a marriage or we're not happy at a job or we're not happy with our parents. That seems, again, taboo to not love your mother.
That's right, because we're taught through different tapes what the norm is.
Right.
So we say we're not happy and we tell ourselves, and we have to fix it.
Right.
And change it.
Right.
And change our lives. And that's what's scary. And that's why a lot of people live in denial.
You know, and
that's
I think
not in Egypt.
It's important too that not every situation, say a love situation, whether it's with family or friends or lovers, not every situation has to be abandoned because you can't find self-love from you can't practice these things from within it. Only you will know that. But I don't say throw the baby out with the bathwater. I say that if you are in relationship, it is the hardest of yogas. The love sexuality relationship, definitely the hardest of yogas. But we're loving against all odds, really, you guys, if you think about it, because we're like, say, a mother, for instance, that is negative or has no self-love, but yet has all the mind dialogue of what a son or a daughter should be. And we're supposed to give that person's supposed to give that to the mother, but the mother doesn't have happiness or self-compassion or innate joy in the heart. But yet you're being asked to and to give it back to your mother. So if in those situations, like most of us, it's too convoluted and you can't practice from within it, then it might be a situation only you can decide that you need to extricate yourself from it to practice on the self. But the minute we make it about the mother is a negative this, or the mother is a negative that, or the son is not doing the right thing, or my boyfriend sucks, if he just treated me better, that is the first signal when we're blaming. Now, does it mean that that's not true? Absolutely not. They could be an asshole. They could be wrong, but they're only wrong for themselves.
That's absolutely
right. And
absolutely.
Once you get into blaming, you're going down the road feeling bad.
Well, and to me, once you get into blaming, it's great. Because that's the arrow. Imagine like the red light district with all the lights flashing. You know, have sex here. Work, it needs to start here. That's what it says to me. The minute I start blaming, I go, yum, yum, yum. Now I know where I need the work. Because if I need to be right, I need to prove to everybody, including that person, that why they're wrong. And I need to drill it in their head.
You recognize that in yourself. But that red flag or red arrow in most people's lives has to hit them in the ass time and time again until they say, okay, no more.
Absolutely. Yes, and that's why
a lot of people... I wish that for people.
I do, too,
I wish that for people.
I do, because I think that that's why we're here. I don't think we're here to say Catholicism is wrong and Judaism is right, or Sufi's great and America stinks and whatever, all of it. We're not here to be pointing the finger at everybody else. It's nice if we could learn this stuff and softly point the finger and hold the mirror up to ourselves, because everybody is an example of where we're at.
Yes. And I hope from what we're sharing and discussing, people are touched and can recognize and relate to something in themselves that maybe they can just take an honest reflection and just say, you know, I've been there. I've felt that. What is that about? Maybe I can do something to find my joy and find my love.
Get curious, right? Wait, can I just read the fourth one?
Yes, I was going to ask you if you did that. Yes.
Yeah. So the fourth one is inclusiveness. So it means that you don't ever turn around to someone that you're feeling true love for and say, well, that's your problem. Your suffering is your problem. In true love, there's no separateness. Your suffering is my suffering. Your joy is my joy. It's not discriminative. It's not discriminative.
Well, we become empaths with each other, which means that we feel each other's hearts. You don't have to suffer for the other person, but you have to understand and have compassion for them.
Yeah, and there's no difference between you and them. So who...
What was that called again?
Inclusiveness. No. Inclusiveness. Yes. Non-discriminative.
Right.
Looking at that, okay, so we have happiness, right? Compassion, joy, and inclusiveness. Now I can look at that and say, who the hell has all those things? But remember, when I repeat them like that, it sounds like you're just supposed to have them. I'm saying, you know, shift the lens here that all of life is a practice. Nobody's saying your love is not right, and nobody's saying your love is not wrong. It's saying that the love starts in here, that how in the world can we give compassion to somebody? That's more like empathy, when we don't actually have the experience of compassion for ourselves. It's like the difference of me holding a hamstring complex or just teaching somebody to stretch their hamstrings, never having felt and seen how it slides and moves and pulls. It's a different relationship to it. Now, obviously, we can't all experience everything every moment, but it's the realization that the pushing away of things, it's usually coming from our lack of experience.
Right, from the ignorance of it. And sometimes the unwillingness to change or be open, and that is fear-based. Again,
right.
It comes down to that. A little, fast little story. My mother lives in the past. That's where she lived, and that's how she knew it. And she could recount what people said to her that bothered her 50 years later, and sometimes the people were dead. So one time she was complaining about a cousin she had a fight with about 60 years before. The cousin was long dead. And I said, Mom, why do you keep bringing this story up? Can't you let it go? She said, no. And I said, why? And she said, who will I be? So she was a conglomerate of all her anger and her resentment and what she remembered as negative. And that's who she was.
Right.
And she never changed until the day she passed away. Not everybody changes. Not everybody recognizes. Not everybody wants to. Not everybody gets out of their denial.
I think that's okay too, don't you?
Yes, I do. Because if we were all the same, it would be boring as shit.
Yeah.
We're all different, and we all, it's a big quantum soup that we're swimming around in. And everybody comes here with a different story and a different way to get some kind of knowledge of what am I doing here? Why am I here? What's my life about? Who am I really?
And you can know things on a cerebral level. and you still have a beautiful journey ahead to understand that when, you know, as a parent, I'm sure you guys understand that feeling of when you first held your child or when that child got old enough to be able to look up at you and say, mommy, and put its hands out, and you were the only one that can soothe it. You know, that's that feeling. If you try to describe it to people,
you can't.
You can't. And even that feeling, which to me is an advanced topic that I won't get too much into. But
yeah,
even,
I was just going to say.
Yeah, even that feeling, it is, because it is a very, you know, it can move to the place of an ego kind of love, mm-hmm. because it's your child and it's my baby and look how beautiful it is. And we do that with our animals too. And by the way, that Buddhist four elements I just read, they believe that for that lineage believes it for animals and all living beings, mm-hmm. all beings.
Makes sense.
So it's better almost, because if we just look at true love and not separating the different types of love, I think that brings us into a nice way to describe the unexplainable of love. Like, work on the true love of the self, the inner compassion, because then the people that are compassionate, they're attracted to you. And it doesn't mean you walk around like, oh my God, I'm so sorry for you. Everything's, or you have inner joy. Oh, I'm so happy. Everything's fantastic. It doesn't look like that.
It's a vibration.
It does shine out of you. I've learned for myself that in the last few years of changing and discovery and things I've gone through, that the reactions I get from people towards me are different simply in the way I speak to people and carry myself. So that light shines out from within.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm holding a book by Osho.
Oh, okay.
I just want to read you what he says about love.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, freedom is our basic condition. And until we learn to live with that freedom and learn to live by ourselves and with ourselves, we are denying ourselves the possibility of finding love and happiness with someone else.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nice, so, Kara. I like that.
All of that inner, you know, the Buddhist way. I know he follows a lot of the Buddhist practice and principles. That's where it all starts. If you don't get there and that love and joy and compassion isn't pure, and, you know, it could take our lifetime and many others.
And yeah, I don't think it's a place to get. I think that's important, you know, because it's not like I'm sitting here saying, I've figured it out. It's just the curiosity to show up as you are. If you're showing up as a bitch, mm-hmm. you're showing up as a bitch. If you're showing up in judgment, you're showing up in judgment. But simultaneously, you're checking in with yourself and you're questioning and you're investigating what is really yours, what's not. And I think all of life is about that cultivation. I do tend to believe that when that cultivation is over and you have found perfect love and perfect compassion inside of yourself, that we probably die.
You're the Buddha, then.
Yeah. That's nirvana.
Right. So then in that case, we are all practitioners. It's just whether we know it or not.
That's right.
So check out this. I love these studies because, you know, yeah, I'm that person. Seeking the balance between the head and the heart. But there's a lot of things that are unexplained. And for the skeptics out there, there is this study that they did at the Baylor School of Medicine. This is a while ago, actually, now, on arthroscopic knee surgery patients, very severe, debilitating knee pain. And they had three groups of 180 people in the study. And they did three things. One is they gave the surgery, obviously, everybody was in on it, knowing that they might have surgery and they might not. I mean, they were all getting surgery. You'll understand when I get to the end of it. But none of this was done against anybody's will, in other words. So the surgeons would go in one group and shave the damaged cartilage and then sew them up. In the second group, they fleshed out the knee joint, removed all of the things causing the inflammation, and they sewed them up. The third group basically got fake surgery. They were sedated. The incisions were made. They splashed even salt water on the wound and then got sewed up. So we have three groups, one that had the full surgery, one that had a bit of the surgery, and another group that had the surgery, but no surgery, no fix. They also all went through the same rehab, and the results were astonishing. So they called this like a placebo group. So the placebo group improved just as much as the other two groups.
That's fantastic.
Whoa. I mean, it's just, you know, yeah, as I dive deeper in to that study, there are a million variables to why, okay? Mm-hmm. So if there's anybody in medicine that's listening to this, yes, a lot of the people in the study were older. Arthritis of the knee tends to hit people that are older, and orthoscopic surgery would not normally be performed on those people because it's not as fixable in your older years. It's more for younger people. But they weren't all 75, not 180 people. They were 75 and younger. So yes, my mind could explain away a lot of this. But if you just look at it and say, wow, like these three groups had exactly the same thing. Nobody was in the know. Everybody thought they were getting the same thing. So even one group thought that they were the placebo group, and they were the group that actually got the real surgery. Yeah. And they're doing the same thing. This Irving Kirsch guy, he calls it the emperor's new drug. And it's that 80% of the effects of antidepressants in clinical trials could be attributed to the placebo effect through these studies. Which is incredible, because there's no side effects when you're doing placebo, and some people even had side effects when they were given the placebo. But the most interesting is this thing called the PEAR Project. So it's a study that was done. It's closed now since, I think, in 2007, but it's called the Princeton PEAR Project. And it's done by this guy who's actually an aerospace science director, but he was intrigued by a student that he had that wanted to measure any changes that happened in machinery. So it's really talking to some of what Rena was talking about in electromagnetic fields and the ability to, that we are all energy and that is changeable, even if it's not readable completely. So they had machines, and people would get hooked up to these machines. And they had, I'm sorry, I'm trying to read through this because I didn't highlight the right things here, but the basis of the whole thing, the conclusion of the whole thing, was that they would hook people up to the machines in different variables. Like they would have one person hooked up to this machine that had a very strong belief in something, and they would get certain anomalies on the readings versus somebody who has no belief in anything and is all in the head. They would get different readings. This is a machine, an electromagnetic machine. I'm probably doing it no justice, but I will give you the website, or you could just Google the Princeton PEAR Project. But the basis of it was that human thought and emotion can produce measurable influences on mm-hmm. physical reality. I know that sounds like woo-woo, but the differences they were getting were especially when two people shared an emotional bond. So if you had lovers, or if you had a mother and daughter, or a father and son, they would get measurable differences. And although small on a large, large scale, that even small amount is unexplainable by science. They would also get different readings when it was a large number of people, like groups, even when they were unaware of the machine. They also had different readings in small, intimate groups, probably like us right here with Zooming in the Lens. They got different readings in group rituals from when they were on sacred sites and musical and theatrical performances. When they got contrasting, so in other words, it was the complete opposite readings were when they were getting readings in most academic conferences or like business meetings or mundane venues. People with no passion that were just talking and talking and talking, no different readings. So these are studies. That one closed, unfortunately, but there's tons of studies. What's happening, though, is that there's not a lot of funding for those studies because we only want to capitalize on that which can build profit. But if these studies, like imagine if somebody was doing a medical study for research in cancer, right? And on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being, yes, we found the cure. In medicine, if there's a 0.5, not even a 1, of unexplained something, they would have $500 million prepared for research in that, because that 0.5 could be the difference between a cure or not a cure. But when it's the unexplained, when it's things like psychics, which, you know, there are a lot of studies out there that prove that oh, I heard a great saying. Where did I find that? I have to find it because it's great. They called it psychic residue category. That's what they put it in. They put psychics and astrology and tarot card readings in the psychic residue category. I thought that was amazing. What that shows you right there, everybody's just shut off. And I'm not saying that I'm exempt from that. I like to think that I have a healthy skepticism. I try to welcome the things that don't make sense to me now, but had I not had that, I would be along with everybody else. And if there was more emphasis put on the things that we can explain, that would maybe show that there's a curve, which I do believe there is, in the world, and maybe mostly, I can only speak of our culture because that's pretty much all I know, that we're maybe not putting so much value in the mind. And when the mind figures out everything, it will then patent it and mass produce it and give it to the commercial world. But there are things that are unexplainable. Now, I don't find a lot of interest in that stuff, but I am interested in our pushing away of it. That interests me because the same parts that are pushing away the unexplainable are the parts that are separating us because of religion, because of culture. You know, CBS did this study on how many people in America believe in ghosts. Can you even take a guess?
I'd say half.
It's half.
Really?
Yeah. Half of America believe in ghosts.
And I'd say a good three quarters of that half or more have actually seen or felt or smelt or heard or had an experience with the spirit.
Hmm. Wow.
But that's another whole bag of tricks.
Do you know that 78% of America believe in the possibility of life after death? Never proven. Nobody's ever died and come back.
Right.
Yet, 78% of people believe that it's a possibility. So wherever those 78%, I'm actually interested in the other percentage, the ones that don't. What are you gaining by just shutting it out?
Again, they're living in fear and intolerance of anything that they can't see.
What about all these studies and books and testimonials on NDEs?
Yeah.
Like the Anita Morjanis and the, you know, James Prague's written about it. Like, what about those people?
Well, I mean, there are the people that have made it their life journey to debunk those things, and some of them have been debunked. Like, there are some people out there that have claimed near-death experience, which is what NDE is, and then we find out that they weren't really brain dead, because in order to have a near-death experience, you have to be brain dead, because if you're not reading brain dead, who you think you are, it resides in the brain, at least from an egotistical standpoint. I'm me. I'm Katrina. I have this. I'm a female, blah, blah, blah. all of those, if the brain, if there's no brain activity whatsoever, and then they come back, I think there's a little more validity in science to be looking at it. It's just all interesting.
It's just all interesting.
And I'm
keeping ourselves open.
It's just, can you be open enough to raise the question of possibility?
That's right. And so I know that it's time for us to end, but I think I'd love to have you guys back because I'd love for us to challenge those out there that just don't have a clue about astrology or that part of the unexplained. And Rena can really educate us. And I'm hoping that my eyes roll, personally. I'm hoping that I feel like, what the hell does that mean? Because there's huge parts of all of us that feel that way. And I'm sure there's parts of you, Rena, that hears things out there in the world that would make you go, oh my, are you kidding me? We all have it.
Of course.
Right.
Absolutely.
And what is the immediate... let's say, solution to fear is to go into it. At least that's the practices that I look at. So let's go into the fear of what is astrology? What is numerology? What is being psychic? Do I need somebody to tell me what's going to happen to me? How important is it? Does it separate us or does it unite us more? You know, in thinking about that love topic that we talked about today, I found this really cool, beautiful quote. Because to me, the only people that have ever really been able to define or attempt to define or make a good picture of what love is the poets. You know, the poetry. Once I opened myself up for interpretations and different lenses to look at all of this stuff, I think scripture and poetry have a way better handle on describing love. And yes, a lot of it does plant its seeds in love of God and love of the beloved. What helped me get over that when I felt that push away from the word God was understanding that God is also inside. And that might be blasphemy to a lot of religions. But what I say, not to that, but in continuation of that, is that if it helps you, if you're a parent, you know how you feel like you love your child more than you can even love yourself. The purpose is the same purpose of, say, Hinduism in trying to find things more important than you to truly find the experience of love. And so loving for God or having a place to worship and rituals, they're all ways that can allow us to create a different experience outside of just the love we feel as humans, which usually is romantic love, or I love you because you do this for me, or I dare anybody out there to write down why you love the people you love and look at the list and see how much that list has to do with you. So on that note, here is a Sufi poet named Hafiz. He was around about, let's say, there's a lot of conflicting data on when he was around, but say, just for the sake of it, about 1320 to like 1325 AD, around that area. And he was actually from south central Iran. And this is a poem called "I Have Learned So Much." I have learned so much from God that I can no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even a pure soul. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known.
Wow. From the 1300s? Is that what you said?
Yeah. 1300 AD.
There've always been questioners. Yes. There've always been people close to spirit, close to the earth, mm-hmm. close to nature, close to even understanding about caring deeply about who they are.
Wow, that was very
cool. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah, it's from The Gift. It's a piece of work by Hafiz called The Gift. And that one was translated by Daniel Ladinsky. He's awesome. But yes, so what's he saying there to me in practical languaging is that when you can love outside of what you're getting back, you can name that anything you want. Mm-hmm. When you can love Absolutely. Outside of receiving right. back, you don't need to get hung it's up pure. Any longer on titles. Because the titles of Christian or Jew or Muslim or Buddhist or man or woman, those are the roles and models that we use in life because the mind feels like it needs a definition. It needs a box. And love is not in the box. So That's if right. we could get outside of our box, the curiosity takes you to all of these poets. So define what love is and try the color, waking up in the morning and picking out the color, because the greatest love really is, you know, found on the inside, because then it's just an abundance. And I know that sounds esoteric and sure, but... Rumi also says there is a voice that doesn't use words. Listen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. On that note with color,
yes.
just to end my little part of this, Kara's birthday is Saturday,
Ooh.
29th, and it is a full moon, and the color is black because the full moons are associated with colors. And the color is black, and the color black, it's all colors. That's what it means. It's the nothingness, the isness,
wow,
the emptiness, and the fullness.
All right, I can let that in. I'll let that slide.
Yeah, it's called the corn moon. So you know how you go to the supermarket sometimes, and in the vegetable and fruit department, there's always fresh corn and tons of it, and people are picking at it. Go Saturday.
Really?
You get some real sweet, good corn.
Go it's Saturday.
Last, yeah, it's the last picking of the corn.
What's the date Saturday? Is it the 28th?
The 29th of August, when my darling Kara was born.
Mm.
And I'm not saying the year. But it's a full moon, and it's in the sign of Pisces, which is the last sign, and it's about the medicine woman. And the medicine man and the shaman in all of us, which we will talk about at another time. The full moon, however, is a reality. I don't care who questions what. You can never stand in front of me and say there's no such thing as a full moon. It does affect us. We are quite a bit of water in our bodies, like 73%. It moves the tides and it moves the water in us. And I'm wishing everybody a happy full moon and my daughter a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Kara.
And blessed
thank
be
you.
To all of you, and thank you for listening.
Yes, and I want to thank Kara and Rena for joining Zooming in the Lens for this podcast, and we will be back, and I'm going to end it with a quote from Krishnamurti, who I just love.
I love Krishnamurti,
Me
too.
Me too. Oh, God. Good, good, good. You'll dig this one. Freedom and love go together. Love is not a reaction. Oh, man. I mean, there's so much more to it, but wait a minute. That is all we've known of love, right? Is that love is a reaction. Like, oh, you went on a date with this guy, and then you date him for months, or you went on a date with this girl. Well, I'm in love. It's a reaction, right? He says, if I love you because you love me, that is a mere trade, a thing to be bought in the market. It's not love. To love is not to ask anything in return, not even to feel that you are giving something. And it is only such love that can know freedom.
All right, woman.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Love you. That's for real.
Thanks for joining us for Zooming in the Lens. If you'd like more information on Ian Hatton for music or editing, please go to mixforpicks.com. If you'd like information on buying Rena Joy's book, There Are No Secrets, please send an email to renajoy@optonline.net. She's also available for phone and Skype readings. You could also shoot me an email at zitlcourse@gmail.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you soon.